Chapter 8. Diaper Deals. How Corporate Profits Shape the Way We Potty. When baby Kira learned to walk, at just 10 months, she would toddle everywhere after her mom, following her into the bathroom.
"What doing? What doing?"
Kira would ask, cocking her head to the side and looking quizzical. I'd tell her, "Mommy's going potty," her mom, Angela Akins, remembers. But despite Kira's interest, Angela, who was 22, was convinced it was too early to start potty training.
"I didn't want her to feel a sense of failure if she couldn't do it," Angela explains.
"What do I say if she has an accident? She's so young. I didn't know if physiologically she could do it." When Angela finally brought home a potty 4 months later, Kira loved it so much she would talk to it, sit her dollies on it, and sit on it herself. Still worried Kira was too young, and even though the plastic diapers Kira wore gave her a terrible rash, Angela did very little to potty train her daughter, besides letting her be naked around the house. But by 18 months, Kira was out of diapers, dry at night, and going potty by herself. She potty trained herself. She wanted it that badly. Now she says,
"Get out, I need private time,"
and does everything by herself. She even washes her hands, which I think is pretty good for 2 years, 7 months. The 21st Century Fear of Potty Training. In the early 1950s, before the widespread use of plastic diapers, 90% of American children were potty trained by the age of 18 months. By 2001, the average age of potty training rose to 35 months for girls and 39 months for boys. A decade later, most parents assumed that 3-year-olds will still be in diapers. Teachers and medical doctors report a rising number of incontinence problems among preschool and school-aged children. As one doctor puts it, toileting troubles are epidemic in Western culture and alarmingly on the rise. Up to 30% of children ages 2 to 10 are chronically constipated. And, as any parent who takes her child to the playground can attest, it has become increasingly common to see 4, 5, and sometimes even 6-year-olds still in diapers. American parents have come to fear potty training, worrying they will inadvertently harm their child in the process. Tiffany Van Dueg, a mom of 4 in San Diego, was told by her son's preschool teachers not to rush. "It will happen when he's ready," they counseled. Sensible-sounding advice, echoed by pediatricians, psychologists, and child development specialists across the United States. This American aversion to potty training has largely originated with one man, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, who invented the concept of child-led potty training. Brazelton's idea is that children, not parents, should decide when they are ready to use the toilet. Though parents today aren't as familiar with him as parents were 2 decades ago, Brazelton is one of the giants in pediatrics. A well-respected and much-loved doctor who is among the most famous pediatricians in America. His CV spans 25 single-spaced pages, revealing that he has authored or co-authored more than 100 scientific papers, 140 book chapters, and 35 books, which have been translated into more than 20 foreign languages. Instead of dictatorial potty training using punishments and rewards, Brazelton believes parents should have a relaxed attitude toward potty learning and simply follow a child's lead. "I began to realize if you allow children to find their own way to the toilet, they would do it," he tells me when I visit his office in Boston. Not based on scientific study or on expertise in urology, Brazelton's idea came from his observations in his practice. If you allow them to watch and learn by imitation and finding their own way, they began to feel like, when they finally did it, "Wow, I just did it. Aren't I great?" he elaborates. And so standing back and allowing the child to take the lead was eminently successful, And that's what led me to my theory children will train themselves if you give them plenty of time, and many children aren't ready till they are 3 or 4. While Brazelton's notion of child-led potty training sounds smart and easy, delaying potty training actually makes it harder for children to learn to stop using their diaper as a toilet and start using the bathroom. As the current epidemic of toileting troubles shows, delayed potty training harms children, who are having more accidents, withholding bowel movements, and contracting more urinary tract infections than ever before. It also makes more work, more cleanup, and more headaches for parents. At the same time, child-led potty training has been a fantastic boon for the disposable diaper company that has paid Brazelton hundreds of thousands of dollars to promote their products over the years. The advent of disposable diapers. As a kid, I remember loving Mr. Whipple, the harried, bespectacled supermarket clerk in the TV commercial who admonishes customers not to squeeze the Charmin while absentmindedly squeezing it himself because Charmin is irresistibly soft. In 1957, Procter & Gamble bought the Charmin Paper Company. After the purchase, the company searched for new products to add to their paper line. An ingenious, energetic, and creative inventor worked for Procter & Gamble, Victor Mills. Mills was known for thinking outside the box. He revolutionized soap production by devising a simpler, continuous process to make ivory soap in lieu of the expensive, time-consuming batch-by-batch method. He came up with the idea of using milling machines to grind flour so finely to make Duncan Hines cake mixes a consistent texture. And he also thought up a processing method to make every Pringles potato chip a geometrically perfect saddle shape by grinding the potatoes into a slurry, pressing, and then baking them. It was Victor Mills who developed the earliest version of Pampers, which hit the market in Peoria, Illinois, in 1961. A plastic rectangular product packed with crepe tissue that fastened with pins. These diapers were bulky, expensive, and so gimcracked that one dad remarked that if you had as much tipped the baby, the contents of the diapers would fall out. The paper core of the diaper, though absorbent, held the urine against a baby's sensitive skin, causing a terrible rash. Replacing the crepe tissue with cellulose only made the diapers bulkier. But over the next 20 years, the plastic diaper improved. In 1968, Kimberly-Clark, which makes Huggies, introduced Kimbies, which were shaped to fit a baby's legs. In 1976, Procter & Gamble elasticized the leg openings to keep the diapers from leaking, and inventors at both Johnson & Johnson and Dow Chemical came up with the idea to replace the cellulose in the diaper's core with a superabsorbent polymer, white plastic balls no bigger than sugar crystals that were made from petroleum and could hold many times their weight. Since the mid-1980s, both Procter & Gamble and Kimberly-Clark have made their diapers with superabsorbent polymer at the core, the same material found in tampons. But initially, there was a problem. In September 1980, Pat Kem, a 25-year-old woman in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died of toxic shock syndrome after using Rely, a Procter & Gamble tampon made with SAP, in this case, superabsorbent synthetic chips of superabsorbent polymer, as well as carboxymethyl cellulose derived from wood pulp. Pat was one of more than 1,000 young menstruating women who had become severely ill or even died after using Rely. Despite the fact that the company knew as early as 1975 that women were suffering from debilitating health problems after using free test samples of Rely, safety studies were ignored or repressed, scientists who exposed the dangers silenced, and consumer advocates belittled. Procter & Gamble instead spent more than $10 million to send 60 million sample packets to American households. But about 2 weeks after Pat's funeral, Procter & Gamble could no longer ignore the mounting evidence against the tampons and was forced to spend $75 million to take Rely off the market. 6 years after it recalled Rely, Procter & Gamble introduced a new disposable, Ultra Pampers. Many parents were unhappy with the product, complaining their babies' bottoms were breaking out with severe rashes and that slimy gel was coming out of the diaper, adhering to their infant's skin. Reported reactions included oozing blood, fever, vomiting, and staph infections, and were so bad that at least one hospital withdrew the Pampers. When an independent laboratory analyzed the diaper, they discovered that Procter & Gamble was actually making Ultra Pampers with carboxymethylcellulose, the same material that had already been linked to toxic shock. For some families, diapers that could be thrown in the trash were a welcome convenience, but just as many households were happy to continue using cloth. Procter & Gamble and their competitor, Kimberly-Clark, faced the problem of how to convince parents to switch from using an inexpensive product that only had to be purchased once and could serve for multiple children, to finally end up under the sink as a rag, to using a one-time product that was expensive, had to be purchased every week, often did not work well, was full of chemicals and perfume, and created the new problem of needing to dispose of voluminous and smelly additional waste. It took more than two decades of aggressive marketing campaigns and redesigns for plastic diapers to become the norm in the mid-1980s. Even once the majority of American consumers started using plastic diapers in greater quantities, Procter & Gamble still had to advertise and market the product vigorously in order to keep babies swaddled in Pampers and Loves, introduced in 1976, instead of a competing brand. Doctors shilling products. Procter & Gamble has been ingenious in its marketing strategies. One innovative way to promote the brand is to create consumer loyalty by pretending to offer unbiased parenting advice to anxious new parents looking for answers. Procter & Gamble's consumer research revealed that American moms responded most to advice given to them by doctors. Pediatricians are most valued and obtain a high rating of 4.5 on the 5-point usefulness scale, reads one confidential internal company document. 3 out of 5 women, 57%, give the highest rating of 5 to the usefulness of pediatricians' information and advice. Therefore, the more pediatricians the company could associate with their brand, either by advising parents to use their products or simply offering advice sponsored by Pampers, the more plastic diapers and other products they could sell. Enter T. Barry Brazelton. At the side entrance to an auxiliary building of the Boston Children's Hospital at 1295 Boylston Street, a locked door and an intercom stand between the journalist and the entrance. Wide corridors, fluorescent lighting, and dropped ceilings make the place seem ominous. But Brazelton's current office in a third-floor suite at the Brazelton Touchpoints Institute, which is also locked, has a warmer feel. Almost life-size color photographs of children hang from the walls. A boy wearing a cobalt blue turtleneck and rust-colored jeans with suspenders, a toddler with café au lait skin in a pink tunic with purple butterflies, a big-headed baby in a red sweater looking pensive. Brazelton's spacious office is filled with the dozens of accolades and awards he's garnered over the years, and the walls are hung with pictures of him posing with presidents and celebrities. Personable, polite, and enthusiastic, Brazelton has an almost photographic memory of the names of the children he has cared for. As he became increasingly famous, parents of his former patients would get in touch with him. He would respond with notes written in his compact, old-fashioned cursive hand, inviting them to stop by and see him, promising them copies of their old medical records. Born in Waco, Texas, on May 10, 1918, T. Barry Brazelton came from a close-knit Southern family. He tells me when we meet that every weekend when he was growing up, his parents would take him to his grandmother's house for Sunday lunch with all of their siblings and children. When Barry was 8 or 9 years old, he was assigned to take care of all the cousins so the grown-ups could eat and talk in peace. In order to take care of 8 small children of different ages, the youngster realized he had to learn to get inside their brains. I had to watch them and observe them and help them control themselves and help them interact with each other and so forth. That showed me how important it was to observe, be involved, and to understand what was going on inside each child's head. From that time on, I wanted to work with children, and I thought the best way to do that was to be a doctor. Brazelton graduated from Princeton University in 1940 and earned his MD from Columbia University just 3 years later, in 1943. In 1969, he was hired as an assistant professor at Harvard University and published his first book, Infants and Mothers, Differences in Development. He wrote 3 more books in just 4 years and quickly moved up the ranks at Harvard, becoming an associate professor in 1972 and a full professor in 1986. Brazelton's interest in observing babies and learning from their behavior, combined with his ability to reassure worried parents and inspire young medical students, made him a natural teacher. In 1998, Pampers developed a large diaper, Pampers size 6, suitable for children over 35 pounds. Procter & Gamble is such a giant that it describes itself as a force in the world, selling products to 4.4 billion of the world's 7 billion people. Our market capitalization is greater than the GDP of many countries, the company boasts. If you look at the small print, chances are your household contains products, toothpaste, toilet tissue, laundry detergent, air freshener, disposable razors, even batteries, made by brands owned by Procter & Gamble. In 1999, Professor T. Barry Brazelton became the face of Procter & Gamble's plus-size diaper. Don't rush your toddler into toilet training or let anyone else tell you it's time. It's got to be his choice, a smiling Brazelton tells parents. One Boston pediatrician, Robert Sedge, was shocked to see his colleague on primetime TV. "I was pretty surprised to see him hawking a product," Sedge told a reporter for the Boston Herald. John Rosemond, a conservative child psychologist and syndicated columnist, called Brazelton's promotion of large-sized diapers a fairly blatant conflict of interest, and decried the idea of delayed potty training as harmful to children and undermining of parental control. Beverly Beckham, a columnist for the Boston Herald, suggested we flush Harvard Baby Doc's diaper pitch, exposing that Brazelton's shilling for Pampers has led to 4.5-year-olds who refuse to be potty trained. This child and all the others like him are the multi-billion-dollar disposable diaper industry's dream, Beckham wrote, and Brazelton is in the industry's pocket. Though it didn't come to the public's attention until the late 1990s, Brazelton's relationship with Procter & Gamble actually started years earlier. From 1983 until the last one in 2000, Brazelton was the host of the Lifetime cable television show What Every Baby Knows. The show, which aired daily in the early afternoon, usually featured an office visit with a family facing a particular issue, followed by a roundtable discussion with parents, and concluding with the central family's story and a solution to the problem. As a TV personality, Brazelton became to babies what Carl Sagan was to billions and billions of stars, an enthusiast, a champion, an expert. During the 1980s, you had the baby boomers becoming parents, wanting to do a good job and running into roadblocks, remembers the host, producer, and director, Henry Hank O'Karma, who wrote many of the episodes. They had a tremendous appetite for information. We could not go into a restaurant or walk through an airport without being besieged by a parent. They would tell him their troubles with toilet training and look to him as a reassuring source. He understood parent struggles. The main advertiser and corporate sponsor of What Every Baby Knows was Procter & Gamble. Then, in 1996, Procter & Gamble invited Brazelton to be the chairman of the Pampers Parenting Institute, an online parenting resource developed to strengthen the brand's credibility, communicate directly with consumers, and influence buying choices through the right third-party influencer, according to internal documents. Procter & Gamble came to me and asked if I would work with them. Brazelton explains to me about his decision to do the television advertising. They offered me a reward for doing it. At first, he hesitated. It was one thing to host a television show funded by advertising from a diaper company. It was another to take money directly from that company in exchange for promoting a specific product. It took me a long time to decide to do it, he told a New York Times reporter in 1999. While personal arrangements between doctors and corporations, in which physicians or researchers would be paid for their services, often for consulting, lecturing, and research, were commonplace at that time, Brazelton worried that accepting so much money from Procter & Gamble might be a violation of his ethical position as a professor at Harvard. Many of his colleagues thought it was wrong of him to align himself with a corporate sponsor. But Brazelton was eager to take the opportunity to convey the idea he had developed decades before that toilet training pressure on young children did not facilitate toilet training and could cause unnecessary harm. He believed the larger diaper sizes would facilitate a child-centered approach to toilet learning and ultimately decided the reward was too great to refuse. Besides, Brazelton tells me frankly, since he already had tenure, Harvard could not fire him even if he was in violation of their policies. I was eager to do it, he explains, and they, Procter & Gamble, funded our television show for 13 years. At 94, T. Barry Brazelton is as charming, outgoing, and avuncular as ever, though perhaps a little shorter and more distracted. Toward the end of our interview, I mention I've noticed more and more doctors are endorsing specific baby products. I ask Brazelton what he thinks of that. I don't like that, he responds without hesitating. Me. Why not? Dr. Brazelton. I think it's tying yourself to a product that you may not know enough about. I think it's dangerous. Me. What's dangerous about it? Dr. Brazelton. It may not be what you think it is. Me. Do you think doctors do it for the money, or do they do it for the recognition? Dr. Brazelton. They do it probably for the money. Delayed potty training causes harm. Linda Sauna, PhD, a psychologist and the author of 12 books about parenting, points out that starting potty training late and adopting a hands-off approach is actually associated with both physical and psychological problems. Bladder infections, frequent urination, bedwetting, low self-esteem, social rejection, and behavioral problems. One child who experienced social ostracism firsthand is Zoe Rosso, a 3-year-old from Arlington, Virginia, who, according to the Washington Post, liked to bake brownies with her mom and make up elaborate worlds with plastic animals. On December 3, 2010, Zoe and her mother were escorted to the door by the preschool principal. Zoe was suspended from the $835 a month Montessori preschool because she defied school policy by wetting her pants 8 times in 1 month. Daytime incontinence and bowel control problems in 3, 4, and 5-year-old children have become more common in the past decade than ever before. Urologists are now studying the problem to figure out why. When Dr. Joseph G. Barone started seeing an increasing number of children with daytime wetting problems, he collected data from 215 children aged 4 to 12. Barone was surprised by the results. The data revealed that children whose parents initiated toilet training before 32 months had far fewer problems with urge incontinence, bladder and bowel accidents. Other research shows similar results. School-age children with bladder dysfunction, including daytime urinary incontinence, bedwetting, and recurrent urinary tract infections, are more likely to have started toilet training at a later age. I've always been a proponent of the child-oriented approach to training, telling parents not to rush training and let their child be the guide, Barone admits to a reporter for Urology Times. I thought that starting a child too soon would more likely result in day wetting compared with waiting and starting the training process later. Our data indicate this may not be the case. Though they may have started with the best intentions, the plastic diaper industry, the doctors who promote them, and the hospitals that give parents free diapers have created long-lasting problems for children whose parents have been duped into thinking it's normal for a 3-year-old to use their pants for a potty. They've made it more difficult and more stressful for parents to potty train their children, and they turned what in many countries around the world is still a seamless process into a money-generating industry. Though very few parenting experts believe we should go back to the more rigid, even coercive training methods common in the 1950s and before, the science shows us clearly that Brazelton is wrong and delaying potty training is not in the best interests of the child. Potty training was not such a problem 60 years ago, says Jean-Jacques Windale, a Belgian urologist who is an expert on this issue. Now it has become a problem. That's surely not because of the child. Physiologically ready between 12 and 18 months. Dr. Windale, a professor of urology, chair of the University of Antwerp's Department of Urology in Flanders, Belgium, and a urologist in practice for 36 years, has been studying the physiological and psychological effects of potty training in healthy children for more than a decade. His team first took an interest in delayed potty training when they noticed that more children in Belgium were having incontinence problems in kindergarten than ever before. In one ongoing study, which has not yet been published, they found that kindergarten teachers now report having to spend up to 1/3 of their time dealing with urinary and fecal accidents in the classroom. Windale contends that, as with all human behavior, there is a wide range among babies, and every baby is unique, but that he and his team have found consistently that potty readiness begins between 12 and 18 months. Neurologically and physiologically, children are ready between 1 year and 1.5 years, Windale tells me in a phone interview. Of course, there's a big variety because every child's different, but it's very rare that a child would be older than 2 years before being ready. While the style of potty training seems to play a role, one study of Belgian school children found that stricter methods result in more incontinence problems later on. Windale has found that a delay in potty training itself causes myriad problems, including anxiety for the child and even higher incidence of disease transmission, like hepatitis B. Windale's research has revealed that a large part of the problem is the kind of diapers parents are using. We found that diapers that have the most absorbency are the worst for potty training, Windale says. Potty training is about awareness and sensation. If you break the link and take away the sensation, you have a problem. The diapers have not helped. They have broken this link, the feeling that something has to happen, and now I'm wet
is no longer there for the child. Because they're so good, so wonderful, and they absorb so much, you can pee many times in the diaper without getting wet. Windale's solution is to leave disposable diapers behind as soon as a child shows readiness. You should leave them out when you start training. Use cloth diapers, or don't put anything on. American parents spend $27 million a day on diapers. Since the advent of the plastic diaper in 1961, the longer babies remain in diapers, the more money is made by the industry. Plastic diaper manufacturers have an enormous incentive to discourage parents from potty training. The numbers tell the story. Since the average age of potty training has risen so precipitously on any given day in America, there are approximately 13 million children in diapers. More than 95% of these children are swaddled in plastic. The average cost of one plastic diaper is about 25.5 cents. A brand name diaper costs about 28 cents, a store brand diaper, 23 cents. Which means Americans are spending an average of $27 million per day on diapers, which amounts to a staggering $9.8 billion a year. A family that uses plastic spends approximately $2,400 just on the diapers for that child, and that's not counting the disposable wipes, diaper rash cream, cost of increased garbage volume, gas for emergency diaper runs, and for trips to the store to stock up on diapers, and other expenses like the Diaper Genie, a disposable pail lined with plastic bags that is designed to mask the unpleasant odors of the diapers until they're thrown in the trash.